Well, if we turn to John chapter 18, we really begin a new section at this point. It's pretty obvious, really, because the way the text runs, we're in the upper room, and I pray they may be in them, and you love them, and your love may be in them, and I in them. And then suddenly, when Jesus has spoken, they went forth. And going out from the upper room, we go into the crucifixion narrative, which every one of the Gospels, of course, majors on. Mark has been really talking about the cross for one third of or the whole of its text, and each of the Gospels clearly presents the crucifixion and the life in the life of Jesus as the climax of Jesus' life. So, chapter 18. And it's going to go through to John chapter 20, the resurrection as well, that we get this is what, if you like, John's gospel is for. It's to present this great act of God on behalf of the human race. When Jesus spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the ravine, or over, it's like a flood stream, you know. It's a tiny little one, but when a lot of rain's there in the winter, it's there, but other times it dries up. Over the ravine of the Kidron, where he was, where there was a garden in which he himself entered. And it's there, of course, that we know the Garden of Gethsemane, where the Synoptic Gospel shows us Jesus praying, and Father, not my will be done, but yours, which is at the heart of the kingdom. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And this is the king with his bringing in his kingdom. We are going to see the kingdom mentioned for the second time only in John's gospel, but the concept of Jesus reigning, getting his will done on earth, has run all the way through the gospel. But now we've got the climax of the story, starting in a garden. He gets buried in a garden, and of course the story of the human race began in the garden. So there's a parallel there, in a sense that it's God's intention for us was a garden. We've made it a rubbish heap, and here is the story of God's action on our behalf, into which he himself entered and his disciples. Now Judas also, who was betraying him, knew the place, for Jesus had often met there with his disciples, possibly during the Passover week or any other times when the Lord had come up to Jerusalem, which John shows us, the synoptics don't, but at other times, three times a year, should have been, could have been, that Jesus, as a good Jew, would have been there. They must have had a sort of rendezvous point, so he and his disciples knew this point. But particularly, of course, in the last week of his life and the Passover, they hadn't generally, I would think, stayed over at Bethany after the first couple of days. They would have stayed here. And in fact, on the last night, on the Passover night itself, Jews were meant to be within so many yards of the city, and Bethany was too far, whereas this would be a place where people would camp down probably for the Passover meal. Jesus, therefore, having received the Roman cohort, a lot of fuss has been made about that. It simply means a battalion, it means a group of soldiers, it doesn't mean the whole, how many thousand, was it 1,000 anyway, led by Chiliarch, 1,000, a centurion only had 100, a Chiliarch had 1,000. It wasn't the whole cahoot, but that would have taken all the defence during a festive time out of the city just to capture Jesus. So it clearly was not meant to be understood. John didn't mean us to understand that he got the whole of the special turnout of the guard in order to of a feast period to come and arrest our Lord. But with them and officers from the chief priests. So there are two parts of the arresting company. Presumably the soldiers themselves wouldn't have arrested, they would have just made sure there was no riot. But the officers of the high priest, were the ones who would have bound Jesus and taken him to Annas, as we know in a moment. So Judas also, who was betraying him, knew the place where Jesus often met with his disciples. Judas, having received the Roman cohort, doesn't mean to say necessarily he took charge of them, just meant that he led them to the place. And they came to it with lanterns and torches and weapons, looking for the Prince of Peace, who was the light of the world. They needed lanterns and torches and weapons. I think that's meant to be a sort of ironic, if not sarcastic, remark as they look for Jesus. Jesus, therefore, well, incidentally, of course, it is a bit of a, well, because it was the middle of the month, the moon would have been at its height. So you had more light on the Passover, 14th, 15th of Nisan, I suppose the first or the last, because the moon begins to wane. But this was, it would have been very light at this time, with the light of the moon. Anyway, they come with all these symbols or signs. Don't forget, all the time you read John, don't forget we've been told it, these signs that we might believe. And they're meant to reveal to us. They're always meant to get deeper than just the factual statements. And so I think you could make something of the different lights and torches and weapons that we use to try and get our way through life, try to understand our way through life, whereas it's Jesus who fulfills all of those. Jesus, therefore, knowing all these things that were coming upon him, went forth and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" One of the things that appears in the Talmud, there's a couple of things about the Lord and his crucifixion, is that Jesus couldn't have been God, because a God wouldn't run away, and his disciples who ran away showed that they were just they were no God at all. Well, of course, here perhaps John is aware of this. We've probably said or thought this many times before, but I'm pretty certain, not everybody would agree, but I'm pretty certain he must have had one of the synoptic gospels in front of him, and he was filling in the bits that weren't there. And one of the things that comes out in the whole of John's approach is what the others have forgotten, or what they didn't think was very relevant, they just simply, he just makes up and puts them in. Now, at this point, he probably knew that one of the attacks on Jesus was he can't be a God, because one, he was crucified, two, he ran away. He didn't run away. It deliberately, John says, he stepped forward and went to them. And the effect of that, as you know, he answered him, "Jesus the Nazarene." He said to them, "I am. Ego eimi," that's the I am that runs all the way through John's Gospel. He could have just said, "Eimi," that's I am, but he said, "Ego eimi," I am, which is the way that the Septuagint translates the I am that I am of Exodus chapter 3. He said to them, "I am he." And Judas, no he there, as you can see, it's just I am. Judas also, who was betraying him, was standing with them. Judas, who was betraying him, was standing with them. Standing on the wrong side. You could bring that out, you know, which side are you on? Lanterns and torches and betrayal? Or are you standing on the other side with Jesus? The rest of the disciples didn't stand there for long. Peter had a shot at it, but didn't do too well. When therefore he said to them, "I am," they drew back and fell to the ground. So you're actually going to get ego eimi, I am, three times here. You get it in the first mention, verse 5, in verse 6, and then again in verse 8, the I am. And he says it again, "When therefore he said, 'I am,' they drew back and fell to the ground." That obviously was meant to communicate the awesome, if not powerful, awesome in the sense that sometimes it just we're shocked and we fall back and we perhaps have the breath taken out of us, perhaps like the Apostle Paul fell down as the light shone from heaven. But it's the meeting of the divine with the human, the supernatural with the natural. It's meant to communicate that they can't stand it, they can't stand in it. And it could be that people made parallels actually with people going out in the spirit. Maybe it was the Spirit of God emanating from Jesus that brought them on the ground. Could be that. You could, but maybe it's just the shock of his presence. It's pretty clearly it was a big impact anyway on those who were trying to take him. It's used for falling into a trance, actually. The Lord certainly anyway came over to them, not as somebody who's just about to run away or hide, but as somebody who is full of controlling the situation, even though it looks as though he's being controlled. Again they asked him, he asked them, "Who do you seek?" And they said, "Jesus the Nazarene." Jesus answered, "I told you that I am. If therefore you seek me, let these go their way. The shepherd is being struck, the sheep are being scattered, but he is preserving them and yet telling them to get away. He's doing the thing that a good shepherd would do so that they are not caught by the wolf. It's the only thing he could do as a shepherd at this point. So he's fulfilling his own teaching, "I am the good shepherd," by looking after his sheep. But the only thing he can tell them to look after them is to get out of it, go move as fast as possible, let these go. So he gives himself, he lays down his life for his sheep. He's enacting it, in a sense, in that particular context of what he'd already taught them. Let them go their way. It's interesting, too, because he says, you remember in the prayer we've just had in chapter 17, he said, "I have lost none save the son of perdition." And here he didn't lose any of them because he safeguarded them by his going forward, his putting himself there and making that, I was going to say plea, but it wasn't. It's almost a command. Let them go. And they'd gone. That was the result. And that the word might be fulfilled that he spoke, "Of those whom you have given me, I have not lost one." That's what he'd said to his father, hadn't he? "I've lost none save the son of perdition." Simon Peter, therefore, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's slave and cut his right ear as a slave. The slave was named Malchus. The fact that Malchus's name is recorded here, probably like Bartimaeus and others, meant that he became a Christian and he belonged to the early church. He was, it seems as though John was not only acquainted, perhaps he was even related to the high priestly family, because he was known, you remember, when they came in. In a minute we'll read more about that. So there were people who were known. John would probably be was recognized in the doorway of the high priest's house. Simon Peter, therefore, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's slave and cut off his right ear. That the slave's name was Malchus. Jesus, therefore, said to Peter, "Put the sword into its sheath. The cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it?" Now, of course, that cup was what was mentioned in the Synoptic Gospels as the cup, you know, "Let this cup pass." And now he's come, as it were, through the prayer. He's ready now for the arrest, and he's very confident as before. He was praying, "Let this cup pass, if possible, let it pass, Father," you know. Now he's accepted it, and he says, "Shall I not drink it?" So it is rather specific, I think, the way that John keeps on elaborating on what the synoptics have said or haven't said to fill out the picture. And we've got it again here, that the Lord was determined to drink the cup, and he says it to Peter, "Shall I not drink it?" This is the only place where it's mentioned, the Father's cup is mentioned. Shall I not drink it? Does it have any allusion to the cup that was in the Last Supper? Difficult to say. That's the cup of salvation which we drink. This perhaps is the cup of wrath which the Lord was going to drink from the Father. So the Roman cohort and the commander and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him and led him to Annas first. Annas, I think you've probably heard a good few times, he had five sons who were high priest. He had a grandson who was a high priest, and Caiaphas the high priest was his son-in-law. He was the influence in those days anyway. For the first half of the first century, he was the most powerful man really behind all the others. They deposed him after his session of being high priest because I think they probably felt that his power was too great, but they had to give in to the family dynasty, as it were, taking over all the time to keep the Jews happy. But he certainly was a very, very powerful player in the whole of the political game of Israel and of Rome. So Annas is mentioned. I'm just trying to think. It's only John, actually, who mentions Annas and that Jesus was taken there. They took him to Annas first. You see, he's obviously looks at the Synoptic Gospels, if he's got them all in front of him, or one of them, and say, oh, well, they've forgotten the fact that Annas... But John, being related, as we see as we go along, to the family in some way or other, or at least maybe only related in that they supplied them with fish, who knows, because but in some way or other was known. And he just reminds them, don't forget Annas was there, and he too is in this whole rejection of the Messiah, the leaders of Israel, led by their leader, which was Annas. For he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. Now Caiaphas was the one who advised that the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die for the people, which you remember was in chapter 12, was it? I think one man should die for the people instead of the Romans coming and slaughtering Israel, as they did later in AD 70. Annas was astute enough to know that if we let Jesus go in this situation, there will be another movement of insurrection on our hands. That's how he saw it as a politician. So he thought it would be much more expedient, more peaceful. We better make more money and have a quieter life if one man dies for the people rather than all the people dying. This sort of thing has been often a challenge in history. Some people thought if they could shoot Hitler, it would save the rest of the nation. So it's a well-known concept, and Annas was working on it at this point. Verse 15. Oh, it's interesting too, isn't it, that a true prophecy comes through such a unbelieving high priest, Caiaphas, yet prophecy can come through. Because it is, as I would argue, it's one of the outward or the out form of expression of the Spirit's presence. That the Spirit can heal people and they don't get saved. He can speak through people and they're not even Christians, Caiaphas in particular. Through their actions, God can speak to us. The Spirit of God all the time is communicating if we will listen in. And perhaps we don't meditate or analyze or weigh things up enough to see where God is actually preparing us and speaking to us. Now Caiaphas was the one who'd advised that the Jews it was expedient that one man should die for the people, verse 15. And Simon Peter was following Jesus, and so was another disciple. There have been lots of discussions of the other disciple, but it seemed pretty clear that it's John. It's very hard to make it anybody else, really. You've got to write books if you're a theologian, otherwise I don't think you're doing anything worthwhile. So there are those who said, well, there was John in John's Gospel, not named, and there's the other disciple in John's Gospel, which isn't John, and so on. But it seems pretty clear that it's John who is being referred to as this kind of the ultimate and most typical of what it means to be a disciple, the one who says, I'm loved of God, the beloved disciple. And that's the beginning of true discipleship, is to know you're loved of God. Peter then following Jesus with the other disciple. Now, that disciple was known to the high priest. That disciple was known to the high priest. Which one? Well, the one that you just mentioned, the other disciple. Does that mean, as I say, some people would argue, does that mean he was a relative, or that he was barely acquainted and everything else in between? Difficult to say. But he was known to the high priest, means that he would have been in and out the high priest's home, even if it was only as doing trade, as a tradesman. And he entered with Jesus into the court of the high priest. But Peter was standing at the door outside. So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the doorkeeper and brought in Peter. So he clearly was very well known, if we can put it that way. Not just a passing person, but somebody who's very well known. And the doorkeeper recognizes John and now will accept that he brings his friend in. So he was outside, has to be brought in. Verse 17. The slave girl, therefore, who kept the door. So the doorkeeper was a slave girl. Might be a bit surprising. I don't know what the practices were in those days out in Judea, but that a girl looked after the door, which might sometimes be threatened, could have been a difficult thing for a female. Now, the slave girl, therefore, who kept the door, said to Peter, "You are not also one of this man's disciples, are you?" He said, "I am not." Jesus just said, "I am." And now he says, "I am not." So you could bring out a big contrast there. The Son of God comes into our lives and we become I ams. Something. I am something. If we keep Christ out of our lives, we're nothings. We are nots. I am not. I am negative. And that was at the heart, I suppose, of the reaction of the betrayal of Jesus by Peter, that he wouldn't stand up and stand with him. He tried, at least he tried with a sword, at least he was following Jesus. Verse 16, verse 15, Simon Peter was following Jesus. It was, of course, it's the final thing, isn't it? Somebody in Jesus' position to be, that's the last straw of betrayal, when your best friend, or the one who's closest to you, or the one that you've put a lot into and expected something out, just turns his back on you in the end. I wouldn't be one of his. So I think that was the particular charge against Peter, as well as the fact that, well, I'd say only trying to make it a little softer, because we do the same sort of thing and we want to be soft on ourselves. Perhaps we shouldn't. It was a dastardly thing. It was a terrible thing. It was a thing that pained the Lord, and we don't want to bring pain to our Lord. Now the slave slave and the officers were standing there, having made a charcoal fire, for it was cold, and they were warming themselves, and Peter was with them, standing and warming himself. The high priest therefore questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. And it was largely, I think, Annas, who was possibly there again with Caiaphas, but it was Annas who, his charges were that he was a false prophet, because he said he'd pull down the temple and rebuild it. You remember, they were looking for people who would agree with that. So this is the beginning, anyway, of his interrogations. Only briefly mentioned, so also Caiaphas, only briefly mentioned, because the Synoptic Gospels have spelt that out very thoroughly. That what we're going to find in John's Gospel is, it is the Gospel where the interrogation is done by Pilate, and his one is spelt out at great length in comparison to the Synoptic Gospels. So it's interesting that, once again, as I suggest, John is reading the Synoptics saying, oh, well, I think they ought to have said more about Pilate, and he cuts the other ones down. He doesn't go through the terrific assertion that Jesus made, and you will see the Son of Man coming, I am the Son of the Blessed, and you'll see the Son of Man coming in glory, and so on. He doesn't mention any of all that in Caiaphas's house. Both with Annas and Caiaphas, it's passed over pretty quickly. So, having charged him on his teaching, it was rightly so in the law. Verse 20, Jesus answered him, I have spoken openly to the world. I didn't do anything in secret. And he then adds, I always taught in the synagogues and in the temple, where all the Jews come together. I spoke nothing in secret. Why do you question me? In actual fact, if this had been the trial that we had before Caiaphas, a proper trial, rather than this sort of quick assessing the situation and trying to draw up an indictment, which it probably was, then it was quite right that Jesus should not be speaking, because the person charged should not incriminate himself. Unlike our law courts, where they interrogate the prospective criminal, you weren't allowed to do that in the Hebrew courts, which is fascinating, isn't it? So it certainly makes it much harder to gain a prosecution. Well, if you've got 12 just and tried and true men, which not always the case for women these days, and here it wasn't a trial by jury, but it was a trial, and one of the laws of the trial, well, you mustn't indict yourself. Perhaps because it was more informal than that with Annas, and it was just trying to draw the charge together, they didn't bother about that particular rule, but it looks to me as though Jesus was claiming it. I didn't speak in secret. Why do you ask me these things? I spoke out in the open, and I haven't spoken behind closed doors. Why don't you ask those who heard me, they will know what I've said. And when he said this, one of the officers standing by gave Jesus a blow, saying, is that the way you answer the high priest? So whether they were trying to fit in with the proper trial and Jesus was claiming they should, or whether it was just a knock the prisoner about until you get something out of him to know what you're going to charge him with, I don't know. Jesus answered and said, if I have spoken wrongly, bear witness of the wrong. But if rightly, why do you strike me? He was not, therefore, being provocative. He was just simply claiming his rights as an unconvicted Jew. He'd not been convicted yet. And this is what they were doing to him. They bound him, they'd slapped him, and he was being wrongly treated according to their own law. So some people have said that Jesus gets a little bit stroppy, is that the word? But that at this point he's being unnecessarily provocative. But he was, I think, simply claiming that they treat him justly. So why do you strike me? Perhaps at that point Annas realized that they'd gone too far and they may as well get on and get him sent off to Caiaphas. Annas therefore sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Now that was still night time, and the fire was, they were warming themselves. When it's been sometimes charged that the trial with Caiaphas was in the night as well, and therefore it wasn't legal. And it also was that he was executed the same day as he was arrested. That's the common picture, and why it is that people have Maundy, Thursday, and Good Friday. That because there's meant to be a day in between the council coming to a conclusion that he's worthy of death, if it was death, and they had to wait 24 hours overnight and confirm it again in the morning, in case any of the council had changed their minds overnight, and to try and be just and to try and be fair. And if that was the case, it's much more likely, as we've seen, you know, with the way Chris reproduced the last days at Forest Hill, that the Last Supper that Jesus ate was the Egyptian calendar come Northern Galilean or Essene calendar, which kept the old one rather than the new exile calendar of Babylon, which John is keeping. So if that was the case, then they'd had a meal on the Wednesday, and Jesus was arrested Wednesday night, and this is Thursday morning now, and he's taken bound to Caiaphas. They go through the Caiaphas trial or interrogation. They say he's worthy of death. They have to wait till the next morning, which would then have been Friday, before he was executed. Okay? So the sort of putting all the bits and pieces together from the different Gospels and our knowledge of the big problem, if you weren't at Chris's presentation, the big problem is how do you get everything in that short space of time, which is arrested Thursday morning, and by the time the Passover lamb that afternoon was being killed and the Friday was going to begin, it's not enough time. And one of the things that I've never seen anywhere else, but I checked it out because the King James Bible, Isaiah 53, says he was taken from prison. Most modern translations perhaps aware of this difficulty as how did Jesus get put in prison. He wasn't in prison, he was just taken from one trial to the next and then executed. But if he was in custody overnight, waiting for the next day when the 24 hours will be confirmed, then we've got a much clearer picture. Now that's the King James translation. Restraint, or custody, one would say today, but then that implies putting in prison. So I thought it was just interesting. He was taken from prison. And it fits in even with the ancient prophecy if we allow this extra day in between. The first calendar is the Egyptian one, isn't it? They come out of Egypt, and all that happens there is they go on using the Egyptian calendar, but with the names changed. The Lord changed the month, didn't he? Name. That the first, this is the first of all months, and you will call it Nisan, wasn't it? And before it was called Abib or something, but now it's called Nisan. But that would be the calendar which by and large existed until they were taken away in exile. It takes a long while to go into all these things, but there were calendars that started at 12 o'clock midnight, that's the Roman calendar. There were calendars that which were the Babylonian and which the Jews adhered to, starting at 6 o'clock in the evening. So the first calendar, the Roman one, didn't fit in with the sun at all, except it was at night time. The Babylonian calendar went by the moons. Not surprising, they were jolly astrologers. They were always looking at moons and things. Well, so, of course, with the Egyptians. They had the different moons. And then just to confuse it even further, you know, there were calendars that started at sunrise. And you start counting as soon as the sun appears. So all those calendars sort of get all mixed up with people trying to work out the dates and to see how they line up together. Now, my son's done a pretty good job in showing the three of those calendars anyway lining up together, which is one of the convenient ways of doing it. So that we can get our heads around what was taking place, how and when and where. But this would have been, this one that they were running here was after the exile, and it was the main one, it was the one they stuck to, but it doesn't fit in with the Roman calendar. And the Roman calendar, as I say, was again its own thing. It started at 12 o'clock midnight. The interesting thing is that the Egyptian calendar, which went by the board when they were taken away in exile, was still being used by the Samaritans. And therefore the Samaritans, who kept the law, and not the prophets, but kept the law, had to work out when they had their Passover. But they would be had a very strong case, because they go back to the original dating to say, we are not going to have it when you people have it, because you're doing it wrongly. We're going to keep the Passover on the day that comes up according to our calendars, which was slightly different every year, but it was between about 2 or 3 days. And this, in AD 33, it was Wednesday. And that's when it seems that Jesus had that Passover meal. Jesus answered him, "If I have spoken wrongly, bear witness of the wrong. But rightly, why do you strike me?" Annas therefore said, "Oh, I've had enough of this. I can't cope with this." So he sent him off to Caiaphas, the high priest. Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself. And they said to him, therefore to him, "You're not also one of his disciples?" I think it is quite an exercise of mind to fit in the four places where the betrayal, or the denial, I should say, of Jesus is mentioned. I think it was still the girl, the gatekeeper. It was a woman who first of all challenged. But here it just says they. So it came out. They therefore said to him, "Are you not also," probably because he has just been mentioned that the gatekeeper, the woman, and the officers and so on were warming themselves. So they, perhaps she was the spokesman for them. The slave girl said, "You're not also one of his disciples, are you?" I wonder, by her saying, "You are not also one of his disciples," might mean that she knew that John was. But there we are. If so, John was pretty brave, I think, sticking it out there and taking Peter in. Yeah. Now, Simon Peter was standing and warming himself, and they said, and he denied it, said, "I am not." Same again. So it's fascinating. "I am" three times, and "I am not" three times. You could bring that balance out. Except that I think we've marked it off that you finish the first section that is coming up this Sunday. Is it 14? Yeah, it's not a bad place to stop, I swear. 26. And one of the slaves of the high priest, being a relative of the one whose ear Peter cut off, being a relative of Malchus, said, "Did I not see you in the garden with him?" Peter therefore denied it again. And immediately a cock crowed. Again, I don't want to go into lining up the synoptics with John. They each of them say the cock crowed three times. Was one of the cocks that crowed or twice? Or was it one of the cocks that crowed was the bugle that was blown, and it was called the cock crow to start off the day? And so we got all these little bits and pieces which make it all far too complicated. We want to get something over to people. And they denied it and said immediately a cock crowed. They led Jesus from Caiaphas into the praetorium, and it was early. And they themselves did not enter into the praetorium in order that they might be not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. So you see, virtually nothing is said about the trial before Caiaphas, which from the synoptics I think we understand was in the high priest's apartment, was in his house. They led Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and scribes gathered together. And that would be in the daytime, in the early morning when the Sanhedrin had gathered. Peter had followed him at a distance, and so forth. The chief priests, the whole council were trying to obtain a testimony against Jesus. It doesn't say whose house that was, does it? Like Matthew often does, he squeezes everything together. Remember the three entries of the Lord into Jerusalem, all squeezed into one. And he's done the same here, I think, with the different trials. But the main bulk of it there is the official trial with Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. We've jumped over that very quickly and gone straight into verse 28. They led Jesus, therefore, from Caiaphas into the praetorium. It was early, and they themselves did not enter the praetorium in order that they might not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. There are all sorts of theories of why they thought they might be defiled, but any home or house or place where Gentiles lived would be regarded as contaminating, because they had less strict rules about burials and so on. So you could be contacting something which is in contact with the dead, because you're that sort of thing. And so the Jews were very, very careful, and particularly the Pharisees. And to defile them, they took 7 days, I think, to, if I remember rightly from the Old Testament, if you were defiled, you needed 7 days before you were clean again. So you wouldn't have had you would have missed the Passover. Pilate therefore went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" They answered and said to him, "If this man were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you." Which is pretty snide, isn't it, really? The word delivered comes up again and again, and the night when Jesus was delivered, says the Apostle Paul, seems to be one of the important words concerning the crucifixion. "We would not have delivered him up to you." Pilate therefore said to them, "Take him yourselves and judge him according to your law." The Jews returned to him, saying, "We are not permitted to put anyone to death." Which was pretty wise. If the Romans had allowed anybody to put anybody to death, not themselves controlling it, you would get the sort of chaos that we're heading for if we start having people helping other people to die, assisted death. We would be in the place where all sorts of abuses would take place. So anyway, they had enough sense not to allow the death penalty to be in the hands of locals, that the word of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spoke, signifying, symbolizing, signifying, emphasizing these things. These signs were written that you might believe. So we are meant to see a sign in this very clearly. We're meant to see a sign all over the place. Obvious one, of course, Judas went out and it was dark. It was night. But here, just to make quite sure we get it, because we're not so good at spotting these things as the Jews would have been, we're reminded. He did. What was the significance? Well, it was when he'd said, "If the Son of Man is lifted up, he'd draw men to him. Prince of this world be cast out." So the significance of crucifixion was that Jesus was going to be lifted up. And instead of the lifting up referring simply to the ascension, the lifting up was going to be, "This is the glory of our King," who we'll see termed King in a minute. The glory of Jesus is that he is crucified, and that he dies in that appalling agony and awful manner. But it was meant to be seen, as for the believing heart sees it even today, as the most glorious thing about what is happening. This is the true reign of God. It is that he is getting his will done on earth, and it's getting it done by his Son being crucified. And what Jesus is going through is changing and governing the world scene, whereas what we do is just continually get it worse again when we try to reign. So this was significant, where death is being lifted up and he's being lifted up onto the throne of the cross, and by that to the throne of heaven itself, where he shows out the glory of our God, which is a glory of love and of restraint and of self-sacrifice and service. What kind of death was he was about to die? Is the kind of death that was going to show us what God's heart is like. And you can make much of that, can't you? Pilate therefore entered again into the praetorium, and he summoned Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" That question is in all the Gospels. Every one of them records that they asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" This begins the first interrogation of Pilate, and quite a lot of theological, therefore, pronouncements and assertions. Jesus answered, "Are you saying this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me?" I think it was pretty obvious that they'd already informed, as far as they could, Pilate, that this man's charge is that he's claiming some sort of kingship, because they're going to shout out, you know, "We have no king but Caesar." That was the final last straw, and as it were an expose of the whole thing, that they were forced to the position through what takes place through Calvary to declare their true allegiance and show what their hearts really were. But at this particular point, they'd probably said, "Look, this man will cause an insurrection. He calls himself the king of the Jews." And that was probably already being put to Pilate privately before this more public affair begins. "So do you say this of your own initiative, or did others tell it of me?" Pilate answered, "I'm not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and their chief priests deliver you to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world." All the way through John's Gospel, we have seen that there is another, let's call it realm rather than world, because the world has got its bad connotations, another dimension. It's not of these dimensions, of these three dimensions. It's of another area, a dimension. Or it's another realm, another place where the kingdom of heaven, the realm of heaven. The word kingdom, realm, same thing, basically. And so what the Lord is emphasizing here is that the kingdom, or the type of kingdom that he's a king of, is different from the world's, as clearly as that, that it's comes from a different origin. My kingdom is not of this world. By that, he is accepting the question of, in a sense, of Pilate, "Are you a king?" He's saying, "Yeah, well, of course I am." By saying, "My kingdom is not of this world. I am a king, but not your sort. Not of this realm is literally not from here," is the actual Greek word. You see them in the margin of the NASB. It would suggest that it's not derived from, it's not out of, not out from this world. So it's something that comes out of heaven, out of the unseen world, out of the spiritual world and the realm. Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" He has answered it and said, virtually said, "Yes, I am." Jesus answered, "You say correctly, for I am a king. For this I have been born." Nice little phrase, born to be king, taken up by Dorothy L. Sayers, who wrote stories and plays and detective stories, as well as obviously honoured our Lord. He's born to be a king. He was born to reign. The reason why Jesus came, was born into this scene, was in order that his kingdom might come into this realm. So he was born to be king. "For this I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth." So it's a kingdom which is from another realm, it's a kingdom which is from heaven, it's a kingdom which is a kingdom of truth as opposed to error and lies. Everyone who is of the truth if you've come out of the truth, if you've been born out of the truth, you will hear my voice. Pilate's reaction, what is truth, demonstrates he has not yet been born of the Father, that he has not been born of God. If he had been born of God, if he had been a man who repents, he would have received the truth. The Father would have given him to the Son, and in giving him to the Son, it means he would be able to believe. Repentance precedes faith, and faith comes because we are given by the Father to the Son. Who are the ones that... Why do I make a fuss of this? Because when I debated with that jolly Calvinist on the premier, three times I tried to press him from my interpretation of John chapter 6, that those who are given by the Father to the Son are clearly declared by Jesus as those who hear and learn from God. Those are the ones that come to me. Those are the ones that are given to me. Those are the ones that Father draws to me. But he just rattled on like as though he's got his Calvinist parrot putting all the stuff out, and I found it very difficult dealing with a guy like that. How can you argue when there is no acceptance and no receiving on either side? Well, there we are. He's not used to receiving anything from anyone but himself, I guess. And that's been unkind to him, but I haven't told his name, so it doesn't matter much, does it? So here we are. Jesus says, if you were of the truth, basically he's implying, if you were the truth, you would have accepted it. Pilate answered, so you are king. Jesus answered, you say correctly that I am a king. For this I was been born to be king. For I have come into the world to bear witness to the truth. The only way to get into the world was to be born into it. And I'm witnessing to the truth about heaven, the truth about the earth, truth about God, the truth. And everyone who is of the truth, anyone who says, I want to be a true man, anyone who said, I've not always been true, but I'm sorry and I want to be, everyone who's of the truth hears my voice. Pilate said, what is truth? Well, you can make much of that statement, has been done again and again and again, isn't it? Perhaps an answer is, who is truth, is an answer to it. That's the real question. What truth is? Who is truth? A little bit like I often say to people, the question really is not, does God exist? But if he does, what is he like? It's not so much, does truth exist, but if it is, what is it like? Or who is it like? Either what or who. What is truth? And when he had said this, he went out again, because he didn't wait to hear any reply, did he? Which again is so often the case, isn't it? People don't really want to hear the truth. That makes us responsible, if you hear the truth. And when he said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, I find no guilt in him. So over this particular matter, he did know what truth was. How about that? He knew what truth was. Well, this man is innocent. So you know the truth. And loads and loads of people who say, well, you can't tell what the truth is. Well, what is the truth? The very fact that we talk like that means the truth is around somewhere. There wouldn't be lies and counterfeits if there wasn't the genuine answer somewhere. So when people avoid the issues of life and of truth and what's it all about and say you can't find out, nobody knows, what is it anyway? One says this and another says that. When you say that sort of thing, it demonstrates that we've opted out of the inquiry. But the fact is that the next moment we will be saying, oh, what are you doing stealing my hat, you know? What are you doing cheating through the underground or whatever it is? We all know what truth is in the final analysis when we're pressed to the point, and so did Pilate. He knew he was dealing with a man who was being set up. and somebody who said he was a witness to the truth. And he was being now a witness to the truth by saying, I find no guilt in him. So at least there was that kind of response taking place. He was acting the truth even though he didn't believe in it. But you have a custom, and this is his first, the first subterfuge is to try and get people to let Jesus go by saying, what is truth? But I find no guilt in him. I find no untruth in him. But the second thing is, he now says, but you have a custom that I should release someone to you for the Passover. Do you wish then that I released to you the King of the Jews? It is rather fascinating, I think, that no evidence has been found for this custom of releasing a Jew, releasing a man before the Passover. But there is recorded in the Jewish religious writings that if a man who is about to be released from prison wants to take the Passover, he can under certain conditions, along with people who are not mentally fit and things like that. They can eat, they can have the Passover. There's a whole list of things, which seems to indicate that there might well have been amongst the Jews a bit of a tradition of releasing somebody at the Passover, because it's a festive time. And if that was the case, it wouldn't be surprising if that then was transferred to the Romans as a part of the deal between the Romans and the Jews when they occupied their land and wanted to borrow Annas's money, because they borrowed money from the temple at one time. So it is possible that that slightest of all hints that there could have been times when people wanted to have at the Passover time to eat the Passover, if they were just about to release from prison, they could do under certain conditions. Fascinating, isn't it? But there's no other evidence of this little bit of possible history that they were releasing someone at the festivity. But not an unsurprising thing, I guess. Keeps everybody happy, doesn't it, really? You can join in the festivities. So Pilate, instead of standing up with the truth that he knows, I know this man is not guilty, I want to be of the truth, he tries to find a clever way out by saying, look, you've got this custom, let him go for that sort of thing. He knows they want to kill him, he knows it's wrong to kill him, but nonetheless he's trying to find a way out. This is a way out that would save the Jews. The Jews' face would be saved, and so would Pilate's for that matter. But, they'd have their pound of flesh, kind of thing, but you got a release of a captive. But at the same time, I go scot-free from responsibility. So, do you wish that I should release to you the King of the Jews? Therefore, they cried out again, saying, not this man, but Barabbas. Now Barabbas was a robber. There it's straightforward, a robber, but also we know that he was in an insurrection, he's a murderer, fighter. This was a robber by taking the spoil, which would imply again that he was a violent man. Barabbas just simply means Bar, son of, or born of, Abbas, father, born of a father. So this, you could say, is a kind of a corruption of the Son of God, son of the Father. There is one text, or a couple of texts, I think, or is it only one, of Matthew, where it's called Jesus Barabbas. Yeah. And Origen knew of that. Yeah. It's in his writings, he knew that there was one text that said that. It's much more likely that Christians in transcribing would leave out the Jesus bit than that they would put it in. Yeah. But if you wanted to at least take the
our abbots, God the Father, perhaps slightly backed up by Jesus, was a name that could have been Barabbas's by the look of this one manuscript. I think it's only one manuscript, maybe two manuscripts. But anyway, it's dropped out. But it's still the same concept, that there is an alternative which is completely identical, you might say. But one is twisted of the enemy, the other is the pure offering of the Son of God, to the Father. And it leaves us with a wide open door for preaching substitutionary atonement. Barabbas goes free and Jesus dies. And the fact that Barabbas and Jesus are mentioned in all the Gospels, well, one died in the place of the other, one was released in the place of the other, would make me very loath to ever abandon substitutionary atonement, which was the first bit of the decline, dare I say it in such terms, by this record, but unfortunately amongst certain well-known preachers in various debates. Substitutionary atonement, for some reason or other, is not liked by modern evangelicals, or some of them, those who set up an alternative evangelical alliance so that they can have the homosexuals operating clearly and in everything that they're doing. The love of God is such, he loves them all, he loves the homosexuals, he loves the Barabbases. Well, of course he does, because Jesus died in his place, of course. But that doesn't mean to say that we want people to go on living that way, or being murderers and robbers and homosexuals. We want them to live the way of Jesus. And it's very dismaying and very disappointing, and should never make us feel superior, because it's more like we should be growing, that people are not trying to follow what so clearly is scriptural. And so too with the doctrine of the atonement. I go free because Jesus stood in my place, whatever that meant, whatever the mechanics of the death of Jesus, or the way it actually affects things. The fact of the matter is, he died in my place, and just as Barabbas would have to have said that. So, you know,
in the whole pattern of the Old Testament,
yeah, absolutely. Every sacrifice was in the place of the human being. That's why he laid hands on him. He's taking my place.
Yeah.
They took Jesus and scourged him. There is some debate and inquiry, but again, I just assure you that I believe it's that the synoptics very often, and particularly Matthew, squeeze the records all together rather than spread them all out and pull them all out, like Mark does, for instance. And I think Mark and John are agreed in this one, but there is a slight difference in Luke. Where do we fit in the scourgings? Were there two scourgings? Was there one before he was delivered to be crucified? Does delivered to be crucified mean that he was declared, he's given a sentence? Or was the, prior to the crucifixion, was the scourging a part of that particular way of dying, of crucifixion? Because this one seems to be before Pilate has been convinced that he'd have to let him die.
Yeah.
Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him, which is a strong word. Scourgings were terrible. I mean, they're awful, some of the records of the very entrails of a human being exposed through the whippings and the beatings and the sticks and so on. And the soldiers wove a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him with a purple robe. Now remember, we've had this discussion about kings and kingdoms and kingship. The crown of thorns would have been peculiarly painful. They're probably long sort of stakes sort of stuck into the head. But they would have been like the way in which the divinity would have been displayed in pagan terms by light raying out, light rays coming from the head. Often a divinity was painted that way, a kind of a outgoing halo, the light going out, shining out, startlingly shining out. And you get pictures like that in the Old Testament when God came to Sinai and the light shine out from him, and you'll see that it's they probably had these ways of theophanies, the appearances of God were demonstrated by the light, the radiance coming out. So it's a kind of a mockery there of the of a theophany, of a revelation of God. It's a mockery of his reign, that he's a king, but he's a king which is more than uncomfortable. It's terribly painful. Would have been defacing him, as well as his head, of course, but defacing his face. Terrible to think about. Incredible. Perhaps we don't spend enough time on the cross these days. Perhaps we don't do like some of the old hymns, you know. Dwelling on Mount Calvary, I perceive thine agony. Oh, how vile my low estate, that my ransom was so great. Don't hear that often amongst evangelicals now, do you? Spending time realizing what it is that Jesus went through. And the pain that we must be causing God when we ignore his provision and live in an alternative manner. It's all seen there on the cross. If we spent more time there, we would realize there are things I don't really want to do anymore. Because look what they do to Jesus. That is the impact, if you like, of the worship of the cross, as sometimes it's called. Devotion to the cross. It's beginning to try and get into the heart of what God has done and what he felt, and this is clothing him with a purple robe, kingship again. In the synoptics, I think Mark is it, or Matthew, they put a stick in his hand as though it was like a, you know, means of authority and commanding, and then they hit him with it. There's, if you put all of the Gospels together, get an appalling picture of the way in which Jesus died. But here it's enough, perhaps. Jesus therefore came wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate said to him, said to them, "Behold the man." Pilate wouldn't have been aware of it. John might well have been aware of it. Difficult to say when he quotes him. But in Zechariah chapter 6, many of you will remember, I'm sure, not only is Jesus in the Old Testament prophesied, "Behold, your king comes to you, meek and lowly, riding on an ass, the foal of an ass." Not merely as, "Behold your God," Isaiah in chapter 6. And not only as, "Behold my servant, in whom I delight, in whom is my, all my, you know, pleasure." But it also says in Zechariah chapter 6, "Behold the man." And that is exactly, of course, what unknowingly, obviously, maybe John remembers it, but Pilate wouldn't have done, when he says, "Behold the man." In Zechariah chapter 6 and in verse 12. "Thus says the Lord of hosts, behold, as a man whose name is the branch, for he will branch out from where he is, and he will build the temple of the Lord. Behold the man whose name is the branch." So not only is the king called the branch, not only is the servant called the branch, not only is the is God called the branch, but here we've got the man who is the branch. There are four places where it says, "Behold, behold, behold, behold." There are four places where it says, "The branch, the branch, the branch, the branch."
And this is what branch the man, the behold the man. Okay?
Pilate says it, of course, to some degree, mocking, or is he feeling some degree of sympathy for the condition of somebody that he's declared that he's not worthy of death? Does he think, well, we all make mistakes, doesn't matter much? When he says, I find no guilt in him, you can find the apostles who's like Peter, like Paul says, in him was no sin. You can find Peter saying he did no sin. You can find John saying he knew no sin. In him was no sin. There are different statements like this. I'm trying to remember them all. To define, it shows what the innocence of our Lord. And then you say, well, and his enemies said, I find no guilt in him. It's a very, very strong assertion about the guiltlessness and the sinlessness of our Lord. I mean, you could take that apart and look at the different statements declaring his sinlessness. That would take all morning, wouldn't it, really? Verse 6. When therefore the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out. It looks as though they're getting more and more frenetic. Are we going to lose this case? Are we going to... we're after getting him dead, but now we're not. What is this man doing? Is he trying to get out by humiliating the victim and then letting him go free, having scourged him so terribly? It's because he was scourged so heavily that it was reckoned that he... You know, he fell carrying his cross, and also that he died so quickly on the cross. When therefore the chief priests and officers saw it, they cried, crucify him. Pilate said to him, take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him. You see, he's getting irritated by this stage. And a second time he said, I find no guilt in him, I find no guilt in him. Peter therefore heard this statement. So the Jews said to him, we have a law, and by this law he ought to die. There is something about legalism that will always kill the life that's in Jesus. The law is only meant to be a quick sketch of what a man might look like if he was trying to live righteously. Jesus is a real painting. He's filled in with colour. But the quick sketch is easy enough to measure and see, well, yeah, I've not murdered anybody, and I'm not an adulterer, and so on and so forth. You go through it all, and it's not too difficult to live the Ten Commandments. But when you start to see it in the depth of our Lord's life and take it inside to start with, if you look after a woman with lust in the heart, you're an adulterer. If you are angry, you really would want that person out of your way, you're angry about them, then you've committed murder. When you start to see it all in Jesus and his teaching, it is very, very full and colourful. In this case, then, they say, we've got a law, and the law will kill. Law is always something you try to do by yourself, and not something where the Lord is doing it in you. He ought to die because he made himself the Son of God. Well, that's where we call him a liar, because he's not the Son of God, so they would say. That's what the Muslims say all over the world. Muslims will say he is not the Son of God. We don't use those terms. It's a wicked term. If you say that, you even speak it out, you're fit to die. It's a sin of shirk. Terrible thing to say. So we say he is the Son of God. They say he made himself out to be. When Pilate therefore heard this statement, he was the more afraid. And he entered into the praetorium again and said to Jesus, where are you from? Jesus gave him no answer. Pilate therefore said, you remember it's prophesied Isaiah 53 that he was dumb before his shearers, he opened not his mouth.
Where are you from? Didn't answer. Pilate therefore said to him, you do not speak to me? They know who I am. Don't you know that I have the authority to release you and I have authority to crucify you? I got the power over you of life and death. There's an emphasis in perhaps the word me, if we were doing it carefully. Don't speak to me would come out. Do you not know that I have authority to release you? He's taking the place of God, in other words, isn't it? When we murder somebody or when we put somebody to death, we're taking the place of God. Something to bear in mind with the euthanasia deal. We're making other people murderers, that's the trouble. Jesus answered, you would have no authority over me or against me unless you had it had been given to you from above. Couldn't have gone even this far if he weren't being permitted to do it. For this reason, he who delivers me to you has the greater sin. In other words, the high priests who delivered Jesus to Pilate, they're the ones who've got the greater sin. Doesn't say you haven't got sin. Very often we're in the place where we think, well, we're not in the greater sin, it was the people above us. Well, the people who delivered us. Well, there is a degree of sin, that's quite clear in the scriptures. And it's what often people pleaded, didn't they, in Nuremberg, that they had to do what they were told. It was from the laws from above. As a result of this, Pilate made efforts to release him. But the Jews cried out, saying, if you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar's. Now that's almost a technical term, you're a friend of Caesar. There were people who were particularly favoured by the emperor, and of course they get blessed up with worldly things, titles and positions and money and power. If you release this man, you are not a friend of Caesar's. Everyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes Caesar. So are they really on a good wicket here? They think they're bound to win. It's fascinating too, as far as we can work out, that Pilate at one time was pretty ferocious against the Jews. He wouldn't have cared. He just slaughtered a few more. But the emperor had married Augustus, had married, Tiberius, wasn't it? Had married a Jewess. One of his many, I expect, but I can't remember all the details. Wasn't interested. But it meant that, and he'd been, in a sense, retreating, he'd been in a sort of a retirement, and then he came back into position. And the one in Rome, the prefect of Rome, was the second really in command in Rome. And it had been, there was a man called Sejanus, and Sejanus had been really taking the place of the emperor. Now he's come back into the public, and he's married a Jewess. He's got his eye on some of Sejanus's, petty kings. That Caesar was, Pilate was one of them, and so Pilate had to walk carefully because he got rid of Sejanus, of course, and some of his sycophants will probably be also on the way out if the emperor gets wind of it. And so there were things like that he knew he was not highly favoured at that moment. If then he allows somebody who's a king, who's never been appointed by Caesar. Herod the Great was called a king, and he was appointed by Caesar. But and King Agrippa was another, but most of them weren't. They took it over. This was taking it on yourself. So you will be into trouble. You are no friend of Caesar's. Everyone who makes himself into a king opposes Caesar. When Pilate, therefore, heard these words, he brought Jesus out. He's been going in and out, you notice, quite a few times. Pilate went out, verse 4, goes back in again, went out to the Jews, previous chapter, verse 38. He's going in and out of the praetorium now. This is reaching its climax. When Pilate, therefore, heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down. He sat down on the judgment seat.
I'm sure Jesus would still be standing and clothed in a mocking way as a king. At a place called the pavement, but in the Hebrew Gabbatha. Now it was the day of the preparation for the Passover. It was about the sixth hour, which it's difficult to know which particular timings are taking, but most people seem to think that if it was the Roman time, it would have been 6 in the morning. Perhaps if it was Jewish time, it would be 6, would be midday. So it's probably more likely to be midday, the 6th hour. And that means that Jesus was on the cross for 3 hours. Otherwise it's 6 hours. 3 hours, I guess, is the preferable position. And he said to the Jews, "Behold your king." So he said, "Behold the man," now he said, "Behold your king." He hasn't said the other two. "Behold your the servant and behold your God." They therefore cried out, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!" Now they're getting absolutely frenetic. Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" One last question. You're not going to get away with it, Pilate. You've tried, but you're defeated. You can't beat these men. The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." And now they have been squeezed to declare their true allegiance. And their allegiance is to a god that's like Caesar, not a god who is like Jesus. And that's what, in the end, when you press a worldly church, it has to cry out, "We have no king but money. We have no king but..." And then they present the world's values. So he then delivered him to be crucified. They took Jesus, therefore, and he went out bearing his own cross. Actually, we stop at verse 16, don't we? By the time that covers all the passages until we get to the new section, and there'll be another Ixus week. I seem to have worked it out that way, so I hope I'm right. He carried his own cross, like Isaac carried his own wood up the mountain to the place of the skull. That is going beyond where I think we go, isn't it? Which is called in the Hebrew Golgotha.
Yes, at 16 on June 7th.
Yeah, that's right. I won't be tempted to go on to the place of the skull and so forth, and some of the things we need to think about there. Some people think the place of the skull was Gordon's Calvary, because that bit of near the tomb of Gordon's tomb, garden tomb they call it, as opposed to the traditional site, which is pretty well defaced, I should think, by the the church that's been built over it. But if this were but whichever it was, that's one way of saying why it's the place of the skull. Others said it was where Adam was buried, and this was the second Adam coming in, or the last Adam taking up a new humanity. There's different symbolism that different people want to emphasize. I've sometimes taken it to be the place where, only by speculation, you can't prove it, of course, it would have been the place in Jerusalem where Goliath's, just outside Jerusalem, where Goliath's head would have been displayed to show that the enemy had been defeated when it was cut off by David. Could be. Then he called it the place of the skull, Golgotha. Basically, taking the text and expanding it is straightforward enough. I think we have to prayerfully bring other things to bear on these sections in John 19 in particular, to bring out challenging truth to people, rather than just simply thinking, if I read the text, that's enough. It's that, you know, you need to perhaps illuminate it from other areas. Because we've got, I think it's three parts of John 19, isn't it? Apply those theologically.